Good day, Leonard. Good to talk to you again. I guess first, most people kind of know that you were the founder of Lee Valley Tools and perhaps of Veritas, their production or manufacturing arm. But could you tell us a bit perhaps about how you came to start Kanika?
Kanika was started in response to a longtime customer who was a plastic surgeon and who used a number of Lee Valley Tools in his clinic at one time. He counted 18 tools that he bought from Lee Valley that was used in his clinic.
Right.
And everything from the stainless steel rulers to actually the product that led to us getting into the scalpel business, which was a carving knife we produced that used scalpel blades.
Oh, right.
He came in one day and said, I'm getting rusting on the tip of this carving knife, and I wonder if you can make me a stainless steel sleeve. And I said, What are you doing that caused it to rust? And he said, well, I've only autoclaved it about half a dozen times. That's when I realized he was using this for surgery. And, of course, it will sterilize and all the rest of it. It isn't irresponsible. It was just he is a very innovative person. And he said, you know what? The world needs a better scalpel. Do you think you could design one? And, of course, that's how it all started. And we got into, I thought, well, I really didn't want to leave product R&D anyway. I thought maybe if we start this small medical instrument company, that'd be a good idea, and you know, it'd prevent me from becoming a mall walker with a vacant lot. So that's how it started, and the first thing we designed was a scalpel because of this longtime customer.
Okay, so what was wrong? Why did the world need a better scalpel?
Well, the current scalpel is a plain slab of steel, about 2 millimeters thick and about 8-10 millimeters wide, and now I'm shifting out of metric into about 6 inches long.
Right. That's...
I live in the imperial system yet.
Right.
Anyway, the and it's like a popsicle stick. Well, when you're using that, you have to use your wrist and arm muscles. You don't use your fingers because you can only grip it on the sides, and it doesn't have an ergonomic shape, not for a plastic surgeon anyway.
Right.
And that's what he was interested in, was a scalpel that would let you use the far more delicate movements of your fingers rather than having to rotate your hand. And he said, you know, the slab scalpel is only good for rotation and pronation.
Right.
And he was right.
Yeah.
So that was his concern, and so that's what we designed it.
So how did you do your research to get the ergonomics into the design?
Well, you would look at probably both pens and knives, because scalpels are used in that manner. They're often used like a pen, and they're more often used like a knife, and just the way they hold it. And so you look at all the various requirements a doctor has and design accordingly. But really, it was just to bring it into a more ergonomic shape.
Right.
That it so happens that, like most other things, that was not seen to be a great benefit by some doctors.
Right.
So changing instruments or changing procedures, change is always resisted everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In medicine, even more so, because there's a much higher level of punishment for risk-taking there than
there is
in other areas.
Right. Are you thinking in terms of legislation or in terms of the effects on the patients?
Well, it can be both, but if you're using a new system, it has to do with being through clinical trials and peer review and all this sort of thing, or else you're open to a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And also, in most hospitals, you're not allowed to use a new system. A new instrument isn't so difficult because that's all in the hands of the doctor. And it's a question of technique more than instrument. The instrument has to be sterilizable and that sort of thing. But other than that, it's not so... So the scalpel wasn't so difficult as far as adoption or willingness of the hospital to approve it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, allocating funds to buy it is something else. And given the nature of the functioning of hospitals, the cellular budget systems they have, the inability to move funds between operating and capital, that sort of thing.
Right. So their budgeting is, right, it's siloed, yeah?
Yes, it's siloed, and it's just unbelievably rigid. And, of course, the system benefits are seldom analyzed when they're looking at a product because of these silo budgets. And so the OR budget, they say, well, is this going to save us time or money in the OR? And if you say, well, no, but it'll save a lot in the ICU and home care, and they say, well, then sell it to the ICU and home care.
So are you talking here about Canada or the U.S. or both?
Both. Canada is a bit more rigid because it is all public health care. In the U.S., where there's private health care, there is a greater incentive to save money in the system for a variety of reasons. But in Canada, the way the budgets are allocated in most areas, you have this anomaly where the high cost of patients when they first come into a hospital have to be balanced, or the hospitals want to balance them with some later days when they need minimal attention, where they are just lying on their back waiting to go home, but not having to be documented and transfused and drugged and all the rest of it. So they want to be able to keep patients who cost very little in order to counterbalance the early day costs. So average daily cost is more important to hospitals often than total cost of the patient's stay. So, and this is just, you know, it takes you a while to get your mind around the concept that this is done because of the nature of budgeting, not because of the amount of money. And it's just, this is hard to get used to, that it's better to spend more money than less.
Because
on average, it's less per day.
Yeah. I'm afraid the phrase whole life costing came to mind then. It's difficult enough to get, whole life costing in any industry.
Yeah.
But I understand how that applies in medicine.
Well, so it's.
Right. So I know the you've produced more products than the scalpels. That's what initially created the Kanika, really.
Yeah.
But I know you've developed some other products since then. Perhaps you can tell me a little bit more about, in particular, how you improved and prototyped the quality of your products.
Well, our products aren't terribly complex. The scalpel, we've had to improve it a couple of times. One, to make it safe passing. Well, the first one was just a good scalpel, but it was like the other scalpels, except ours had an ejectable blade. But then we had to make one that was safe passing, and that's a bigger challenge, and we had to do that. Now, to meet the Bloodborne Pathogens Act in the U.S.
So this was passing from one surgeon to another, or?
Or surgeon to nurse, nurse to surgeon.
Okay.
Yeah, one surgeon to another, so that you had a guarded a blade when it was being passed.
Right.
And that's not particularly difficult if you're doing it in a larger bodied scalpel, but there's a sufficient number of doctors who want essentially the slab shape, what we started out getting around. There's a sufficient number that want that we have to have it in that kind of a frame as well. And that's very difficult to squeeze all that versatility into a popsicle stick.
Right.
So, but where we really have not done many instruments recently.
Mm-hmm.
We've been primarily involved in wound closure and wound maintenance systems.
Right.
We have a particular area of intellectual property which involves the relocation of tissue on the body. And I'll just give you one example.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario. They asked us if we could do something for cleft lip babies.
Right.
The problem is the cleft in the lip is often half an inch or three quarters of an inch wide. And if you close that immediately, you get put tremendous tension on the tissues, and you get a malformed. No plastic surgeon can really do a good job because of the amount of tension that will be on the resulting suturing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So they asked us, after they had seen what we were doing with very large open wounds, they asked us if we could move the soft tissues of the newborn's lips, and we said we probably could. We'd sure be willing to give it a try. And actually, we've developed a system that can fully reapproximate cleft lips, so that when sometimes it only takes 10 days or something, with other babies it might take 6 weeks, but we can bring these margins together so that when the plastic surgeon operates, they get a far superior result.
And right.
It has been, actually the patients have been the mothers of the babies, not the patients themselves,
right.
Since they're not of the age of consent. But
anyway, no.
The mothers of the babies, with only one exception, gave us permission to use the pictures of their babies in any promotional material we wanted because they were so grateful to have found this solution. And, of course, the trauma teams, both in the Ottawa hospitals and in a number in the U.S., are very enthusiastic about this. But, you know, the SOD's law applies here, of course, and it's a good thing. The number of cases is relatively small.
Yeah.
2,500 cases per year in North America. And the cost of the devices for each case is only a couple of hundred dollars. So, but it's a case of here of the great pleasure of doing good while you're not doing well.
So how did you go about testing and developing and knowing what the tensions would have to be and those?
Well, I tell you, the if you were to talk to the Canica staff and ask them how long they had worn adhesives
with
elastomers attached to them,
yep,
because you could at any given day say how many people are wearing gear, and they'd lift their shirts and you'd see rows of elastomers and adhesives and so on, because you tested them out. They'd test them out when they're playing hockey and doing this sort of thing. Plus, you can. The critical thing when you're testing is if you do no harm. And that's, so doctors were, who helped us with clinical trials were using this because it was not invasive.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something they could do with a clear conscience. And the product was what you have to do, a huge amount of testing to get rid of any skin irritation or potential blistering and all kinds of things. And you just have to have a cooperative hospital.
Right.
And the Civic Campus of the Ottawa Hospital has been very, very good with us. We've done a huge amount of work there and with good feedback from the doctors there. We've had excellent feedback.
Yeah, because we found in other work, not on physical products, but on computer systems, for example, that when you're working in any high pressure environment, it's very, and when you're dealing with specialists who, you know, whether it's air traffic control or network management, and I'm sure medicine is the same, that it's very, very difficult to get the time of those people and to get their feedback on your products.
Yeah, but they will do it if you show, if they think that your heart and head is in the right place.
Right.
If you're there to get something cheap and dirty done quickly or whatever, they won't deal with you. But once they've realized, if they realize that you're being fully ethical and all that sort of thing, doctors, I have yet to meet a doctor who doesn't care about patient benefit.
Yes.
You know, they just, if you can show there's a benefit to the patient, then they'll pay attention.
Right. The other thing I liked about that story is that, again, in our experience designing user interfaces and so on, is that it, quite often the, you know, technical development teams don't get the chance to get in front of real customers or to experience their own product from the customer's point of view. So I like the way that you got your developers physically involved in the design effects.
But they're also in the OR very
right.
frequently.
Yes.
This is where the Ottawa Hospital has been good again.
Yeah.
And they have training, and they're quiet, and they stay out of the sterile field. But
right.
We have all gone into the OR, the designers, researchers more than managers, but we've all been in there for various operations because you have to see it to appreciate all of the challenges.
Right.
And also to see other things which you look at and say, my God,
right.
you know, we could do this another way.
Yep.
And, but they don't have this, they don't have anything, nobody's thought of doing it another way. Well,
right. yes.
just as we will not think of new cures, they often don't think of new mechanisms.
No, that's right, no. And we find an analogy, and, you know, so many of our clients tell us to ask their customers what they want, and we always insist that there is so much rich information in the context of use. And also that whenever there are problems and challenges, people find ways to work around them. And, you know, just like driving, eventually you no longer become aware of what you're actually doing and where those barriers were. So we always, try and tell our clients to look at real user behavior and the context of use, and not just to ask them what they want.
No, because this is critical in our case too. If a doctor says, this is what I need, what you always have to do is steer them around to the problem and say, what is the problem that you're trying to solve?
Yeah.
Because what he thinks he needs isn't always what he needs.
Because
yes. he's not aware of the range of mechanical solutions
right.
that we might be, for example.
Yeah, the range of possibilities, yeah.
That's right. And so when we know what the problem is, then we apply the classic systems to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And his suggestion is a possible solution, but it's not the solution. And so, and that's a little hard to get doctors to accept sometimes, but
yes.
open-minded ones will, and particularly if you show that this isn't done out of any, you know, venal or malicious thought. This is the way you work, and you want to know what the problem is before you start talking solutions.
Right, right. The usability of medical equipment can sometimes literally be a matter of life or death. And I know there was the recent Canadian adverse effects report, and some of the issues that came up there could almost certainly be put down to product quality and usability, particularly things like over and under dosage. I think the figures were roughly 1 in 10 patients.
Yes.
Have you come across similar situations where the design of the product has managed to make a drastic improvement?
Yes. The what we find, what our concern always is that doctors know how to use our product because the surgeons tend to be very confident people. They have to be.
Yes.
They're going to end up killing people eventually, whether they want to or not. And you have to be strong, and you have to have they have to be like artists. Everybody thinks they're an art critic. Well, the doctors have to have that kind of skin because they're just dealing in life and death. So they can be arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
And, if they don't perform a procedure the way it should be, and when you're just talking, you know, elastomers and adhesives, or it doesn't seem like you could do much damage, but you can cause skin shear, which is a mess.
Right.
It's just you virtually have to put a skin graft on that area if you get skin mm-hmm. shear. It's really a difficult thing to repair. So you have to stop over-tensioning, say, with our wound closure systems. So we do part of that through design and part of it through constant beating on people how important it is not to over-tension, that just right. because when you apply the tension starts to close, for God's sake, don't think that more tension would be even better.
Right.
The limit, it takes time to move tissue. And right. so you, as with any new procedure, I mean, we only know how it works by having watched and worked with doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a certain resistance for somebody coming from outside the field, somebody who doesn't have a medical degree, saying, really, that's too much tension. So what you have to do if you're in the OR at the time is say, well, Dr. Smith has, oddly enough, has found that half the recommended amount of tension is just fine in this instance.
Right.
And, you know, what you're really trying to say is, for God's sake, lower that tension. You know?
Yes, and, but you're having to refer to an authority that they will hold some store in.
You may even have to invent one. But
right.
Anyway.
Okay.
But no, this is, you know, it's the same. Doctors are human.
Yes, yes. And I know one of your customers is the U.S. Army. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how that came about?
Well, it was very interesting. The way they became a customer was we met a young major at a show in the U.S., at a show at a convention in the U.S. where there was a trade show element. And for, I assume, reasons of being able to retain surgeons, they give surgeons an allowance every month of the amount of money they can spend on OR equipment.
Right.
And so this fellow bought one of our wound closure systems. He went back to it, which happened to be for extremity wounds, arms and leg wounds. And he went back to the hospital in the northwestern U.S. and used it. He ordered one from there. He saw our demonstrations and the procedure, how the procedure was done and so on. Went back and used it, and then he was posted to Iraq. Well, then he saw all these leg wounds from IEDs.
Yeah.
And so he emailed us and said, I don't have a credit card over here, and I'm not even sure how you can get this to me. I'm at a forward combat hospital, but have I got patients for your extremity fasciotomy system? So we said, not a problem. We'll send you over. Well, we offered to send him over about $10,000 worth of stuff, and said, and all you have to do is take photographs and give us case studies afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, he groaned a little bit and said, okay. But he and his supervisor, another major, did some 51 operations in a matter of a couple of months with the system. And they were able to take soldiers who would have normally been sent to the Landstuhl, the big U.S. military hospital in Germany, back to the U.S. Instead of that, they were able to put this on, send them to Landstuhl, and the wounds would be closed within. Their average time was 2.5 days to closure on some of these huge gaping wounds of the leg when they've done fasciotomies, which frequently, in fact, normally, before this system came along, resulted in a skin graft.
All right.
Because they weren't closable. And
right.
so, they now have the U.S. Army is our single largest customer of any kind, of any. It's just that the dollar volume customer of the U.S. Army is the biggest.
Right.
Mm. It all started with one major.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then he...
and a small discretionary budget.
That's right.
Wow. So can you tell us a little bit what you're planning next with Kanika? Any other tools under development?
Well, quite honestly, there's at least another 10 years... of work in soft tissue manipulation. We haven't even touched plastic surgery, we have insofar as newborns are concerned, but insofar as aesthetic surgery is concerned, we haven't touched it, and we haven't touched chronic wounds, and we have, and it applies to all of this, the the intellectual property that we have developed and that we have patented, which is the use of elastomers for reapproximation of soft tissue, is
right.
is applicable on any kind of wound, ulcer, or, I mean, for example, it's used if somebody has a skin cancer, say it's the size of a loony, and it has to be excised. It only takes about a week to create a skin depot there with the skin, with some of our skin stretching devices,
right.
so that when you excise that cancer, you can close the wound at the same right at the same time. There's, the skin is there. You've created a depot of skin, so it just
right.
closes the area.
Right.
So what you do is pre-surgical skin stretching, and we've had years of clinical trials on that, and we're just now bringing it into the market. But it may sound odd, but there's just so many things that can be done just in that one area that we probably will be working in it for, well, there's certainly enough work to keep us busy because, you know, it takes years to get to the market stage with any one of these.
Mm-hmm.
And we're fervently hoping to get both there and through black ink. But anyway.
Right. So you have both the patients and the R&D budget as well, hopefully.
Yes.
Yes. Great. Well, that's excellent. Those are great.
We can stop all the bleeding except for ourselves.
Right. Oh, dear. Well, those are great stories, Leonard, and I'm really looking forward to your keynote talk at the World Usability Day. Thank you very much.
Okay. You're most welcome, Mike.
Okay.